Hey, welcome to the Digital Engagement Forecast. I'm Hemming Nelson.
And I'm Brian Kassler.
Today we're going to be talking to Michael Servino. He's the Chief of Client Development for Fracture. And he's going to tell us how nonprofits are using technology to break down data silos. But we also have to acknowledge our beverage sponsor, Charity Engine. They're a nonprofit software platform for online donor management, fundraising, events, and communications.
And if your CRM is driving you to drink, give Charity Engine a call.
Yeah, and that's charityengine.net, not charityengine.com. So anyway, here's our great conversation with Michael Servino.
Fracture.
Oh, that helps. We might turn on your microphone so okay. We can actually hear what you're saying.
There we go. My role at Fracture is Chief of Client Development, and that has kind of two sides to it. One is working with existing clients on their best application of what we've got and informing our product development, both for who we've got installed and then also new customers, new agencies, new software partners. In identifying them and getting to work with them.
So how are people receiving Fracture?
Very well. I came on board in October when we made our platform public. Is when we launched, and we're finding kind of two big things. One, people get what we are trying to do, which is automate the connection between software products and data flows. So make the dirty work of data as simple.
It's all
simple.
About robots, right?
It's little, all about bots.
Is it a cloud API? It's a cloud for a cloud. It's meta cloud.
It's a meta cloud, yes. It's putting bots to work, so programs and scripts that help move data around. We use cloud technology as the backbone, but work with several clients who've got on-premise systems, and it's all about helping organizations and agencies get the data that they want out of the systems they have and move it, parse it, process it, transform it, and get it into the systems that they want to use it for, whether that's analysis or targeting or integration or synchronization. And I've been in this space with nonprofit organizations and marketing and fundraising for 20 plus years now, and there has been very little innovation around the area of data integration and data management in that 20 years. The last five, we've seen the rise of Salesforce and their hub and spoke platform and ability of people to plug into that, largely API driven, which is great, and it's still a lot of technologies out there that aren't built on that and will stay in this sector for a long time, and organizations need to be able to get their information, their data, their constituent records where they need to go for analysis and all of that. So it's kind of a fun space to be in, and every time I explain it to somebody...
How long does it take you to explain it?
Usually much shorter than that. when someone asks me, what does Fracture
do?
You
want to do that again? You want to start over?
I will. I'll say, what we do at Fracture is automate the connection of data from one system to another.
Are you guys a product or a service?
We are a software as a service. So
SaaS. Product.
Yeah. We're software as a service, and there's no installation fee for Fracture if you're using our existing bots in the way that they were structured, and then there's a monthly fee to support the data flows.
I guess so the service part or the SaaS implementation is sort of the aspirational, but right now you guys are you still developing the product, or is it kind of fully featured at this point?
Yeah, great question. We are have about a dozen bots and our platform that are ready to go. It can plug into Facebook, Twitter, Convio, Salsa, Razor's Edge, half a dozen other applications that are very turnkey. And then we are developing new bots and data flows all the time.
So as clients come on, they've got something you need to plug into, you develop an integration, and then you refine it and you release it to everybody else.
Yep.
Is that kind of how it works?
That's how it works.
This makes me think of Zapier.
Know that, I was actually at a conference up in Toronto as a keynote speaker, and I said, okay, what Fracture is if you think about Zapier for nonprofit organizations. How many of you know Zapier? One hand went up. I'm like, okay, let's try this again. So some of the folks listening may understand that, others may not. But yeah, it's the connecting glue, moving dots, data dots between systems.
Well, you're replacing interns, and I mean, it's the truth that any sufficiently large or complicated organization is probably going to have multiple software products, and they obviously would benefit from them speaking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of was the initial – you said you've got like about a dozen bots. What were the initial bots, and how has kind of your interactions and feedback from clients shaped where you might be looking as future data integration points?
Yeah, absolutely. So initially the vision for Fracture was to provide cross-channel analytics to organizations. So Chris Lundberg and April Peterson, the co-founders of Fracture, you know, coming out of Salsa, understood both as executives in a growing company and the need, their own need for, we need to be seeing what's going on in Facebook, Twitter, our email campaigning, our events, how we're affecting our customers. The organizations using Salsa were asking the same thing. What's my ROI across my channels? So the original endeavor for Fracture was around being able to produce those types of cross-channel analytics. And then based on that, push data around strategic segments into third-party systems like Facebook and Twitter and Salsa and Convio for targeting, and then produce the actual digital messaging. As we worked through three different tranches of R&D with what we call cohorts, these are volunteer organizations that helped us to understand their needs and begin to shape the platform. What we learned is the more that we worked on sort of the production and the analytics piece, what the client's feedback was, you know, that report would be great. Maybe it could look like this, but our bigger issue is we just can't get the data out of our systems to even populate that report. Or once, even if we do, to connect it together and attribute donations on, you know, system B to, you know, who the people are in system A. That's what we really need to solve.
Sounds like a lean startup approach.
Essentially, yeah.
Is that, was that, is that, I don't know if you're around back then, but is that a conscious sort of software development methodology with you guys? Or is it sort of like, hey, well, this is what they need and these are the people we're working with now, so let's just build that?
No, it's a very conscious approach that we, you know, identified early on that the movement of data between systems and the synchronization and that, you know, the shtick that I gave before, that core function of being the router of data is hugely important, and no one's truly focused in that area. It's greenfield for us.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a lot of players who I will program my software so I can expose the data or even deliver, you know, drop a CSV file that you want into an FTP location, but you got to pick it up and do whatever you're going to do with it from there. And then other vendors are, we've got this great, you know, import tool, but you need to structure your data. No one's really dealing with that line in between the two systems. And we just see a tremendous opportunity, and we're getting a lot of interest in that from our
Give
from
me
our
an example of like what that means. So you've got, I don't know, what are some of the systems you were saying, like Salsa and Facebook?
Yeah.
So how is that, how are these bots working?
So we will extract out of, I can give you some messaging example and then an integration example. On the messaging side, we have customers who have Salsa or Convio, Facebook, Twitter. They've got ad campaigns that are running on Google Ads, Facebook Ads. And what they want to be evaluating is across all of these messages, you know, what content is working? What are people clicking on? What are they converting on? Where our bots know how to go into each of those individual properties, those systems, and extract out the messaging data, whether it's by API or HTTP request. We can get an email marketing performance report out of Convio and from out of Salsa and get all of the messaging data and messaging response data out of Facebook and Twitter. The sort of secret sauce of Fracture is we've developed a data model that allows us to normalize those very different types of campaign and messaging statistics across those different platforms in a single way that then allows us to grab that and pump it to a data warehouse for a client or visualize it.
So you're not pulling your Facebook data and dropping into Salsa. You're pulling Salsa and Facebook data and
from
pulling
a
into the third-party system. And then doing your analysis.
From there. A reporting, if it's simply a reporting perspective, a reporting example, then we're pulling the data out and delivering it either as a data feed for, you know, somebody to use Tableau or Sisense or something to visualize it. We have some pre-built reports for performance analysis. That's one example. Another example would be in that same case, a client wants, I want to have, you know, all of my folks who are in Salsa I want to be matching them up against who's in Facebook and who's in Twitter. In that case, we're actually wiring Salsa, get those constituents, get the Facebook and Twitter IDs as much as we can from the APIs and what's available, and bounce those up against Full Contact, which is a third-party append service, to then be able to look and know, here's your Facebook, Twitter followers, and then push the relevant information back into the systems. So it's not a direct integration between, like, say, Twitter and Salsa. It's we're taking the data out, we're running it against a third party, finding it out, and then pushing into Facebook custom audiences, pushing into Twitter custom audiences, and then pushing back into Salsa those constituent attributes. The idea, you know, fundamentally the idea we see and where we see the marketplace, the nonprofit technology marketplace going, is that organizations need very specific types of information in different types of tools. That one, you know, single data repository, some are building data warehouses for that analytical purpose, but they still need to get very specific pieces of data, you know, from one place, their email marketing tool, into three places for custom ad targeting. And they need to get back out of their custom ad targeting responders to inform their direct mail marketing database. So the idea of being able to route that data around to different systems based on specific types of information they need is new. And it's something that we see a tremendous opportunity to be able to enable. And that's, you know, part of what we do.
You know, I was actually having a conversation recently with somebody who advises and consults in this space, specifically around cross-channel marketing. And one of the things they keep running into is they're working with nonprofits that are under the impression that they have cross-channel marketing simply because they regularly post to Facebook, they're uploading videos to YouTube, they're sending out an email newsletter. That does not make cross-channel marketing, right? And I think the big problem is it's actually incredibly labor-intensive to manually be bringing all of that information between systems. And with something like Fracture, where you can actually get the big picture overview and be able to shuttle those segments and audiences between tools, that's where you can start actually doing cross-channel marketing. And actually focus on the marketing part rather than the channel part and managing the data flow.
Yeah, and you've just drawn the perfect distinction between cross-channel activity and really strategic cross-channel marketing.
I'm going to use that. That's a good way to put it.
And lots of with all due credit to what organizations are trying to do in what is a new space. I teach a course at American University, a graduate level course on strategic marketing for nonprofits. And the core principle of that, and sort of hammer on it from day one through the whole course, is strategic marketing is audience driven. And therefore, you've got to start with who are our core target audiences? What are those strategic segments? What do they believe? What values do they hold? What point of decision are they in making a decision to give to us or to take an action? And then your marketing plan is all about how do you use different channels at the right point with the persuasive message and your value proposition to move them. And that is very, very challenging to do. Some organizations are doing a great job of that between email and direct mail, telemarketing and email, and challenged to do it in Facebook and in Twitter and in other social properties because it's A, hard to match identity, and B, that who they're talking to on social channels is much more broad than perhaps their fundraising segment. So this is all stuff folks are still working out. But we believe that's where most organizations need to get to, and that the data component is the easiest problem to solve in terms of making sure that your key strategic segments are synchronized across all of your technologies you're using to communicate. That's a solvable problem. The capacity to do targeted messaging and custom messaging and the persuasive messaging in each of those channels relative to those audiences, that's a human challenge. And,
capacity within an organization
that's
already...
Right.
Nobody's working too hard.
Right.
You'd mentioned some Google products earlier. Do you have any bots that sync with or connect to any Google products?
Google Analytics, Google Drive, so Google Docs.
The use case for Google Docs?
Yeah, and Google the AdWords also.
Oh, great. Those three. I mean, those are the ones you'd want. Maybe YouTube, but...
We do have a YouTube bot.
Yes. All right. Well, then that's it. Google Plus?
I'm so ancient. Nobody's on Google Plus. No.
Even Google's hiding Google Plus now.
Google Docs is an interesting use case for us. So we've got bots. So when I talk about a bot, it's, you know, our Google bot. Our Google Drive bot has multiple abilities within it. So any, like our Conveo bot has lots of abilities. And with Google Drive, we've created the ability to handle migrations. So Google migrations from, you know, third party server, you know, cloud. We just migrated a client who literally had their drive, their enterprise drive in the closet in their organization and, you know, used our bots to migrate that all off to Google Drive. That's one way. The other is that the same Google Drive bot understands Google Sheets and Google Docs, and we're using Google Sheets as a way for clients to pass us metadata around things like campaigns and other things, data we're extracting from third-party systems. Very specific example. Conveo and Salsa, there is certain information that's built into those tools around a campaign. But there's metadata about those campaigns, like what the audience was for that, what the strategic purpose of a particular message was, or, you know, some special labeling to it that doesn't exist in those systems, and there's no field to put it in. Our partners are managing those in Google Sheets. That helps us just, the bots can read from that spreadsheet, append it to the data that we're pulling out of Conveo. Again, those two different data sources put together and then fed to them to their data warehouse. Very simple, very straightforward.
So do you find you're getting a little bit ahead of your potential client base?
We're definitely thinking ahead of our client base and thinking ahead of where the sector is. I mean, we're looking at what is the world going to look like 5 years from now? You know, and that's what we are really pursuing with Fractures, that where the market is headed is the expectation on the part of nonprofit organizations that they can adopt a really good system that fits a niche problem. In a sense, I want an app for my peer fundraising, and I all want a different app for my email marketing, and I want a different app for this or a different application, and that they can get those individual pieces that are better technologies and be able to plug them into their system. You know, Salesforce as a model is creating that expectation, and every iPad and Android user is having the same expectation. So that ability to choose and swap in and out tool sets that you need for specific purposes is already happening in the political sector. You know, I need a canvassing app. You can pick one of four that pre-integrate into VAN and NGP and Nation Builder and others. So if that expectation is already there at the leading edge of what kind of technology is for nonprofits, it's not too long to where, you know, your big enterprise organizations are going to want to use one tool for this campaign and another.
Are you finding that there are certain sectors that are adopting this or are at a stage within their own development that they're seeing the utility of it, like campaigns, nonprofits, associations, for-profit companies?
Yeah, this is a little bit biased of my own history because I've, you know, spent a couple of decades now in the nonprofit sector. And historically, political campaigns definitely and parties tend to push the edge of technology. And then following soon thereafter, environmental organizations and conservation organizations tend to be the more experimental and aggressive in using digital technologies. Soon thereafter, you know, a lot of the big charities are becoming much more aggressive in that. Particularly where it comes to on the fundraising side, the health and disease charities, the Komens and the American Diabetes Associations, tend to be the ones that are early adopters of
technology. So we're on the evolutionary chain. Is Fracture sitting right now?
Well, given that
we're working with the Hillary campaign,
We are not yet working with the Hillary campaign.
Are you making phone calls?
I need to remain silent on that issue. We are, you know, you can tell on our client list we're working with Ovarian Cancer of Canada and the Ocean Conservancy and the Nature Conservancy, and so some of the more, you know, leading edge organizations that want to solve their, you know, their data management problem.
So how did they convince you to jump on board? How long have you been there? About 6 months?
I have been there about 8 months, since October. Okay. Yeah. So I, you know, funny, small world. I've known April and Chris for over a decade in my work when I was at Beacon Fire. We were a Salsa partner used that platform. And it was about August of last year, actually, that I ran into April at the Bridge Conference, which is actually coming up next week here in D.C. and got to talking to her about what she was up to, what, you know, what Fracture was going to be focused on, and was really intrigued by that, and then went to a demo party that they held at Coco here in town in D.C., and was just had an aha, oh my God, someone's finally solving this problem moment when Chris was doing the demo and showed the ability to pull this data out of you know, a SaaS solution that at Beacon Fire we had trouble getting the data that our clients wanted. Here was a way to get it easily and automated, and then the data visualizations that he was able to do with it. I was like, I want to be part of that solution. So I actually approached them and asked them, you know, you guys need someone of my talents and skills on your team. One thing led to another, and I started in October.
Wow. Yeah, this is like a real startup atmosphere? How many this people is you a real,
you know, there's a gift and a curse that I've given myself and Chris and April have given me, is that I've always wanted to do a startup. And previously at Beacon Fire, we you know, actually were a management buyout of a nonprofit practice at Commerce One at the time. So, you know, we started with 13 clients and 13 people and pretty close to break even from day one. This is a very different venture, true startup, you know, where we're building, you know, the product was pretty well built by the time I started in October. We had, you know, not just a viable product, but one in place with several clients. But it's been a developing, you know, a client base and a revenue stream from the ground up.
Mm-hmm. And you've been going directly after clients, but I have to wonder, have you, or can you talk about actually trying to partner with the vendors themselves?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
This is clearly an additional selling point for them. Somebody comes to you with, you know, well, we have Razor's Edge, which, you know, it doesn't really do email, so we're looking at Convio, we're looking at Salsa, and then one of those companies can say, yeah, we have this integration through Fracture with Razor's Edge.
Yep, you nailed it. And those conversations are happening. We really see and are engaged with three, you know, key areas. And I think for anybody who is looking to develop a, whether it's a services company or a software company, you know, the three major players to address are, one, the nonprofit organizations themselves. And that's enterprise clients that have big data needs and data analysts and engineers internally. We're talking with them because we can take a lot of the low-value, repetitive data feed, data clean work off the plates of their analysts and let their analysts spend more time with the data. The, you know, individual organizations who just want a point-to-point integration or maybe data going to three different places, that for us is a very turnkey solution set. And we're agencies, the direct marketing and digital agencies that are working with these organizations need data feeds from these nonprofits for predictive modeling and feeding their statistics system. And that's all things that bots can do very simply, which the agencies don't necessarily have the staff capacity to take on a lot of that. And the organizations themselves can't add that to their queue of yet another thing they have to do is provide this data. So we're a solution set there. And then for the product vendors, we're talking to quite a number of the, you know, big names you know and smaller companies that you know, have new solutions coming to the market, because they all want the same thing, which is we want our system to be able to talk to other systems because that's what our clients want. And we don't necessarily want to be an integration company that spends a lot of our engineer time building a connector to every point solution out there.
Brian and I have talked about this before, but it's sort of the new philosophy is you sort of build your API first and then you build your software on top of it. But I know that's not true for a lot of the software that we've tried to integrate things with. I mean, you know, LinkedIn just threw us a big curveball.
Yep.
Like, does that happen to you guys a lot where, you know, people are, you know, fine, they say, yeah, we want to be open and connect, but ultimately we have to please our shareholders or we need to make money or we...
Sure. I mean, we work with Facebook. They, you know, the version 1.0 of the API was great. Version 2.0 that they came out with a couple of weeks ago, not so good if you want to get the actual identities of people who are commenting and liking and sharing. We assume that at some point there is going to be a... you know, paid for data access so that they can monetize that information. But for right now, yeah, that impacts what, you know, what our bots are able to do in the same way it impacts what a human can do. You know, essentially our bots can do everything a human can do. The difference is, you know,
call my wife and tell her I'm going to be home late tonight. Brian made us late.
We do have that bot actually, the automated tell my spouse I'm going to be late. But I think for one of the key conceptual differences around Fracture and that I really like about it and is so different than any other tool I've worked with is we're not limited to the API. So because, you know, we can train our bots to log in as a human would log in, click through to reports, customize the report to get custom fields that you can't get through the API, click to execute the report, you know, set the date parameter, and then the bot will wait until the report is done. When the Excel file is there, it'll download it, parse it, push it into a data set that now we can use for integration. You know, that's fundamentally different than building an architecture for your system that's around your API's ability to talk to another API. That's why for us data flows are so important. Yes, we can, you know, bots are set up to work APIs, but not all APIs have everything available. And yet we have clients who want all of their information. So that flexibility is just a different paradigm, and that's an innovative new way to approach this, we think, than how most systems.
But that takes a lot of care and nurturing and constant updating because they change the navigation and
less than you would, you know, less often than you would think. And our experience in the last 2 years is that the user interface for reporting in particular and user interface for import-export changes very little.
Convio probably hasn't changed in 20 years.
They've made some enhancements, and we'll be making more. But even,
you're
you know,
going to be too nice to everybody because everybody's you're working with everybody.
We have the possibility to work with everybody. Yes, but this is the other piece, right, is one of our clients, had spent two, three weeks of engineering time, solid engineering time, building an ability to get data out of, I believe it was Facebook. It was either Facebook or Convio. And finally get it up and going, and then a change is made to the interface, and a change is made to the API, and they're back at the table for another week and a half. You know, for Fracture, it's our business to make sure that the data comes out of the system. So for us, you know, we anticipated that it was coming, and in one case, we were informed that it was coming, and had it up and ready to go that day because our clients depend on us getting the data out. So that's a sort of a big difference around what's your core business.
I kind of at first blush, I have to say that the idea of it automating clicks seems not the right way to do it. But at the same time, one of the things that you can see startups have learned from paying attention to the API space is you do not build your company on another company's API.
Yeah.
You know, you see companies go under overnight because Twitter will shut off access to something. And so as much as it is a kind of a janky workaround, it probably is more robust and more stable than actually integrating with some of these.
Compliment.
Yeah, it is something.
It has proven to
but
be.
It's more of a disgruntled comment about the industry as a whole. And I wanted to at least pick your brain. Have you been following any of the conversations around OSDI?
Have been. I mean, for me personally.
What's OSDI?
Open Standard Data Initiative. Mm-hmm. It is a project started by a few folks that looped in some of the major CRMs to essentially standardize the schema, so it's just the database language, across how data is stored and transmitted. So it's, you know, it's probably not going to happen with the current generation of products, but you imagine once the standard is approved that it could be taken into account in the next generation of products, and suddenly a donation is a donation, no matter whether you're on a Blackbaud, Salsa, you know, XYZ company's product. They have a unified language that they're able to share between. But at the end of the day, they're probably not going to build the integration. So it's still, even if that's adopted, you're still going to need something like Fracture to actually do the grunt labor of moving the data. You know, plenty of companies, like you said, have APIs, but they don't build the integrations.
Right.
I say, you know, that's the developer community, yeah. Or go hire a consultant and pay them, you know, exorbitant amount of dollars.
Yeah, because there's two, you know, there are two pieces to what's not, what's still needs to be done, right? The understanding and timing of the data that we're pulling, what are the parameters, you know, date or campaign type or whatever. You've got, you know, some call that you want to make to, either limit or expand the data you want to pull from that OSDI. And then the pushing of that into another system, you still have the business rules, mm-hmm. right? And I think this is the level of kind of nitty-gritty that is why people don't want to do integration, is you pull it out of, you know, pull a bunch of data out of donor drive and its transactions, and you want to bring it into your Razor's Edge, or you want to bring it into NXT, or you want to bring it into Salesforce. Every client has a slightly different way that they are coding within their system, you know, the nitinoid code for who is a Team Razor participant, who's a Team Razor leader, and how do you want to code a particular transaction. There's not a standard for the coding itself. Mm-hmm. There's a standard field for coding, but you still got to go through that translation layer. And to us, great, OSDI will make it much easier for us to do the out and in, but there's still all the transformation work that needs to be done, and the timing and triggering. And that helps one system talk to another. Totally agree. It has the upside of doing that. It doesn't answer the question of I want that data I'm pulling out of system A. I've actually got to feed five different systems. I need to feed my data warehouse. I need to feed my direct marketing data mart. I want to push strategic segments into Facebook. I want to, you know, on and on. That's a lot of data push and pull. So you're either going to script that all, or we think you're going to hire bots to take care of it.
I have a really important question. Who took the bottle opener? Brian, you're going to get fired if you keep this.
That's right.
We're going to have a word from our sponsor.
It's the worst exit interview.
What can I do better?
Leave it to the biz dev guy to
what is it you
Bogart, the most important tool in the company, the bottle opener.
So who do you see as your competitors?
It's a great question. Again, you know, I have a pretty binary worldview in that they generally fall into a couple of categories. One, custom data integrators. So these are professional services firms that are doing point-to-point integration or
Omatic.
Heavy integration. Second, are software products. So Omatic is in that. There's a couple of other tools like that specifically built for Razor's Edge. MuleSoft on the commercial side, Talend on the commercial side. I mean, there's some very large, sophisticated data management tools and data flow management tools that are out there, very few of which will ever be purchased by nonprofit organizations. And, you know, the third is the potential of the vendors, the software vendors themselves. So, you know, the donor drives and the classies and the Blackbods and et cetera, the list goes on. The extent to which they invest their own technical resources in taking the data from their system all the way through to a Tableau table, you know, if they want to invest in that, that's competitive to us. We think that's not very likely. Mm-hmm. The biggest competition is coming, you know, from the potential competition is really data, the custom data integration. And
so your argument is that it's cheaper, it's more efficient because you're doing it for across the board for all these clients, and then you're offering it to everybody. And is that
the reality is there is not a solution like Fracture in the marketplace that is focused on nonprofit systems and automating the data in and out and across those systems. It is all very disaggregated.
So you guys have selected your market share to be, these are the systems that, you know, nonprofits mm-hmm. go after. You're not going after large corporations. You're
correct.
Focused on the software that I guess we basically talk about every week on the podcast.
We're focused on the nonprofit space. Marketo is an eventuality.
Sits in between that space.
It does sit in between that space, and there is interest, particularly in the enterprise, you know, large mm-hmm. enterprise nonprofit organizations, in using Marketo and plugging it into their, you know, into Razor's Edge or into ROI or other solutions. So yes, that is an integration we could do. But again, that choice is made because there is a nonprofit CRM in the mix. And, you know, and that's why we would do it. We do not see our future anytime soon of, you know, integrating Salesforce and some other solution for, you know, Fortune 500 company just because they want to have us do that. We really do believe that the nonprofit sector needs these solutions, needs to be able to deal with these. They just, you know, think about it. Right now, there are at least 1,000 nonprofit organizations who are spending software engineering time around trying to get their email list on one of two platforms to talk to, you know, or pass data with, Facebook, Twitter. And so that's, you know, 1,000 data engineers who are spending that time doing the same thing and not really producing value to the organization's mission.
You'd you'd mentioned some of those competitors earlier, and I agree, they're not really good options for a lot of nonprofits. Mm-hmm. Not only because usually the integrations are pretty crappy, but usually they're incredibly expensive, mm-hmm. whether it is a one-time setup or ongoing monthly fees. What's the pricing structure for Fracture?
It's on our website, $2 a job. So the way that we price is, you know, for us, a data flow is made up of a number of jobs that need to be done. A job is log in and pull file data from a system, system A. Job number two is standardize that data into the Fracture data architecture. Job number three is filter that data for the client's particular parameters and dedupe it against some file set that they have. And then job number four is push that into the target system. So that's four jobs, $8 a day times, you know, 30 days in a month. That's $240 a month to run that process. And that's a, you know, essentially a core integration.
What kind of setup does that take?
If it's using a standard Fracture bot setup, then all we need is username and password from the client, because we just need access to the system to pull the data in the standard way and bring it across the line and push it.
How often are they standard?
Most of the social stuff is, most of the data feeds on performance, so probably 40-50% of the time they're fairly standard. Mm-hmm. And then the customization work is really around what are your filtering rules and what's your field mapping.
And is that the hourly rates or something?
It's $150 an hour, and we estimate what that cost is up front and do it as a fixed fee for the client. So most of our customizations have been somewhere between $500 and $1,000 to customize. And that's the point-to-point integrations. We have different pricing and a different model where we're dealing with enterprise clients or agencies that may be pulling 10 data feeds, you know, from 10 different systems and wanting to pump it into, you know, their data warehouse and do some integration work. Those are typically $2,500, $5,000 a month installations for the enterprise clients.
I'm going to ask the question that Brian always asks, which is, tell us like the coolest integration that you guys have implemented, like that people will go, wow, that's cool. I didn't think that you could do that.
So that's great, because I think it's really the coolest one we've done, because I lived in this spreadsheet world for, you know, 10 years in my career. We're working with a direct marketing agency, Avalon, and they do great digital work, and their account folks produce in a spreadsheet the campaign plan for an email. And that's, you know, multiple tabs, and it's all manual data entry. Go in and what data are we emailing, and this is an appeal campaign, and then go and another tab is what segments are we emailing, and all populate it, go into Convio and, or, you know, Salsa and look up the quantity for each segment based on some group report that you run and hand key that into the spreadsheet, hand key the costs, and you've got your mail plan to show to the client of here's what we're going to email, right? Lots of quality human person time doing really kind of mundane email creation. We this week will go live with bots that do that process end to end, that will go into Convio, run all that data, bring it down, produce the Excel spreadsheet with a segment and the campaign codes and all that, and push it by email to the account assistant, who can then be reviewing it and forwarding it on to the client. So we've taken hours of work in kind of monkey spreadsheet.
When is that kicking off?
Actually, we were on the phone today with them reviewing the final prototype, so it should be Monday or Tuesday.
So is it purely with Avalon for direct mail?
It's,
or can it work with other direct mail firms?
It's built to work with other direct mail firms, yeah. And for nonprofit organizations internally. I mean, that's the thing, is that the data extract can be pointed to any other system. The idea of a bot is that we can line up bots to do different jobs. So the one piece of it that's proprietary to Avalon is the bot that is specifically engineered to deliver the spreadsheet in their proprietary format for their clients. But that bot, take that one out and plug in the, you know, I don't know, Beacon Fire bot, that they have a different format for their spreadsheet. So that idea that we can script a bot that can take a bunch of data out of a system and compile it into a spreadsheet, run a chart, run a graph, and shoot that off so that, you know, we're enabling campaign reporting to be done in that format. Or we can publish it to a JavaScript, you know, beautiful online report, which we have. Or we can push that data into Tableau and the structure you need to run your own report. You know, that's,
and is this primarily Chris doing all this programming?
Chris right now, yeah.
I've got an idea for your next bot.
Yeah.
It's a Mechanical Turk bot.
A Mechanical Turk.
You know what a Mechanical
bot.
Turk is?
No, no.
So
enlighten
me. It's a, you can just Google it, but it's an old trick where it looks like to the person walking up to the fortune teller that this robot is giving you your fortune. Mm-hmm. But in reality, there's somebody sitting underneath the, you know, the cover in the box manually running the robot. Mm-hmm. And actually Amazon offers something like this where you can take a very simple discrete task and put 1,000 people on it, and maybe it takes them 5 seconds a pop, but it's basically something that probably should be automated, but mm-hmm. for whatever reason you can't automate it. Put it in front of a bunch of people and don't worry about the fact that they're getting paid pennies, you know, pennies per click. You just get the approved data back.
Hire an army of people in the Philippines to log in.
No, we are not. There are not an army of people in the Philippines.
Put in some instructions. Yeah. Don't worry how the sausage is made. Just put it in there. You come back the next day. Yeah. Whatever. You know,
it's done.
There may be a few spelling mistakes, but it'll be fixed.
We're going to open Fracture with a PH, and we're going to hire. It's just going to be a manual process, and we're going to.
How do we know? But you're, so people are giving Fracture username and passwords. How do we know it's not already Mechanical Turk? How do we know it's not? It's you know, once a day. It could just be going to Bangladesh.
Or the
wizard behind the curtain.
Yeah, you know, the way they know is that, you know, if they really want to be certain, we can show them the underlying code running.
What code is it? What's it written in?
This is where it gets a little more into Chris's area. What's
your platform?
Yeah, we're on.
Let's make some stuff up.
No, I'm not going to make
just
stuff
say
up.
Ruby on Rails or something.
It's not
that
Ruby
sounds
on Rails.
Good. It's definitely Ruby. No. It's a Python. Ruby on Rails?
No. Our back end is Amazon Redshift is what we're using for the column database, and most of it's JavaScript. We've got the reporting tools are, I want to say Mondo.js is what we're using for the rendering of quite a number of the data visualizations that we're doing.
So what's the dream scenario? What 5 years we have you back on the podcast? What are you going to be telling us?
What am I going to be telling you in 5 years? We're going to be telling you in 5 years that we are, you know, super excited to be hitting our $20 million, you know, revenue number, that we've connected, you know, all but two
your stock options have
nonprofit system.
You.
Yeah, no, that. Yeah, I think that
got
that
a garage
for
full
us
of motorcycles.
A garage full of motorcycles. Just one is all I need. Yeah, my sons Michael's will have
motorcycle
their motorcycles.
One a week.
My sons will have their motorcycles. No, I think that truly is like we want to be so pervasive as the circuitry that's connecting systems together, and we see that possibility and that potential and the interest in having somebody do it that we're stepping into. That we do expect to be 20 million in 5 years, and really, you know, potentially at that point branching into the commercial space where there's a need for it.
I think
because we've solved the nonprofit problem.
It's the Wild West right now. I feel like it is kind of a transformational time. It's people are, you know, there's, I don't know what the numbers are, but let's say it's 10% of the organizations out there can talk to you and say, like, I can see how we can use Fracture to further our marketing, to get better number out of our big data. But I would say there's, you know, 50% that are like, you know, who's got the password for our Constant Contact? Like, we've
it's
got clients who think Constant Contact is a CRM, and they're perfectly happy with that, and they're, you know, they don't know anything else. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is, and they're not our target market. I mean, I think for those organizations, you know, for someone that fits that profile of, you know, Constant Contact is my CRM, and that's very much my homeschool association.
Maybe the question is, are you too far ahead? I mean, it's like you guys are banking on the ability of organizations to be able to leverage the information that you can provide them.
Yeah.
And I don't see most of my clients having even that capacity.
Well, I think when we're so there, it's a yes and no. So yes, that thinking is ahead of a good portion of the nonprofit sector, and that's just because for a good portion of the nonprofit sector, they don't have, you know, they just don't have the internal staff that are doing the predictive modeling internally and are really doing higher end data analysis. That's kind of the nature of the you know, bell curve of where people are in terms of their capacity and their capability and their resources. For the organizations that are at the high end of that bell curve, right, that have, you know, 10 data analysts and data engineers on staff because they're a $100 million organization and trying to figure out how they reduce their marketing costs by $2 million and increase their revenue by $2 million, they're the organization that has the capacity through themselves and their agencies to really leverage the data. And what they want to be doing is spending the most amount of time they can in the developing of the models and in the understanding of the analysis and in the creating strategies, and as little time as they possibly can getting the data from place A to place B. So for us, that's a big marketplace.
If you can give nonprofits and agencies back that time that they're losing to this, mm-hmm. you deserve every dollar of that $20 million. Like, it's incredible what nonprofits pay to agencies to do this type of data export, migration, manipulation, just to generate reports that, in all honesty, probably should be there in systems already, but they're not. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, until technology catches up, it's still very important to be doing this work. Right. But there's not a lot of options right now unless you've got money to spend, and this sounds like something that could be more manageable for most nonprofits. Yeah.
And you said something that's really great. I mean, I've found it frustrating that I expect there ought to be some of these reports in these systems. That, you know, why aren't these core systems producing these types of integrated views or producing these types of performance reports or dashboards or snapshots? And, you know, part of the reason is that there's not enough of their customer base to drive that kind of development for their engineers and their system. And yet, as marketers and fundraisers become more professional and are more skilled and more trained, and that sort of the IQ of the whole sector increases there, and it's smart now, people are very dedicated now, and learning and sharing, great, the expectation for getting those kinds of reports go up. And it creates a marketplace for someone to create a turnkey company that develops really good high-end reports. I mean, Integral is a company that's doing that just focuses on providing return on investment reports to clients. And, you know, they've made a good business out of it. Target Analysis has made a good business out of doing that. You know, we think that if we can, you know, fracture the boundaries to getting at data and free up the flow of data, someone's going to step into that space and say, hey, we've got pre-canned reports that for $100 a month, you can look at your ROI across all of your channels, and suddenly release those tools to a much larger portion of the marketplace that can then make their investments more efficient, that can get more out of their marketing and grow their nonprofit. Maybe it's a world of idealism, but it's why I do what I do.
Where does fracture come from? You dropped that term in there pretty slickly.
Yeah.
So what is that? Where did the name of the company come from?
Exactly that notion of fracturing the silos of marketing and fundraising, and fracturing the silos, limiting cross-channel campaigning and cross-channel effectiveness for nonprofit organizations.
I remember when April and Chris started the company, and they sent out their first email about it. And if you went to Facebook and you typed in fracture, you got some like German nihilist, you know, spelled with a K, fracture organization. There was a little confusion in the beginning there. Like, why are you advocating anarchy?
That may be the real story, but the one I'm sharing.
You mentioned that you've always wanted to be involved in a startup. Is it everything you dreamed of? Like, what?
It's everything I dreamed of, and a lot of things I wasn't.
Is it like an episode of Silicon Valley over there at the Fracture headquarters?
No, it's not that crazy. It's not that crazy.
Smoking bongs?
No.
You got a big head you keep on the roof?
No. I think that the part of it that I absolutely expected and was looking forward to was the creativity around the discussions and the solution concepting the solutions. Where, you know, yes, we've, you know, having a phone conversation today with a particular organization, they're looking at, you know, they want this point-to-point integration. A service, the services background I come out of at Beacon Fire is like, great, we can do that, and we'll get the requirement. It's very linear about how we'll make that happen. It's a completely different thing and a completely different way of thinking and concepting a solution to say, we're going to approach this problem to solve it for this one organization, and in doing that, build software that can solve a similar problem for 1,000 organizations at scale. Completely different way of looking at the world and thinking about how you solve a problem. So that's been very exciting. The stressful part of it, you know, yeah, it is. It is tough in a startup, particularly
you're working
in the first
harder
couple
than
of months.
You were in the last 5 or 6 years of your life.
Yeah, yeah. I would have to say that I've had to step up my game from where I've been in the past 2 years, in terms of the, you know, level of effort and intensity, and I think the intentionality. So for me, I call it the intentionality and impact, right? That I need to be very focused in what I am doing is going to have the greatest impact on growing Fracture, because it's easy to get caught up in a lot of stuff that may not have any meaning and may not have any impact on the bottom line and creating that replicable solution. So there's a new filter to my thinking that's kind of different for me.
We were talking before we started recording about the various stresses and opportunities and the difficulty balancing that in an organization as it grows. And so I think do you feel that now, like if there's a half dozen people working at Fracture, you know, you're taking out the trash and you're answering the phone and you're doing the business development and you're writing proposals and you're developing the product. I mean, at what point is it too much what's my question?
Are you trying to scare away our future podcast guests?
Exactly. I was like, wow, that's a load of
questions. Tell us.
Well,
tell us.
The great news is that, you know, we're in a co-working space, so we don't have to take out the trash or worry about the wiring of the phones or any of that.
But... My question is really, your title is sort of a business development title, but it sounds like, you know, as you're describing what happens there, I mean, it's kind of there's a really small core team and you're developing this product, and your responsibilities don't end at business development.
Yeah, and that's where discipline is paramount for what each of us does, right? Because it is easy to find ourselves, and we do, you know, in really lofty conversations and exciting conversations around, God, we could go here, we could go there. If we could, this could be a whole separate product line, or we could develop this services line, and to get into that blue skying. When, you know, practically speaking, today I need to make, you know, 10 outreach phone calls and I have 6 follow-ups and I have 2 demos, and that is a full 10-hour day. So it's incumbent upon each of us in a startup to be really disciplined about making sure we're doing the high impact work that needs to be done to keep and build the business and, you know, feed our soul and feed our minds and having those blue sky conversations, because actually in doing that, I think a number of those conversations we've had around where we could be in 5 years or what we could look like have helped us go from, you know, have helped us evolve even just the last 8 months about what our core focus is. And in doing that, rule out some paths that we're not going to go down, because right now those, you know, are a distraction or very crowded spaces, or it takes those conversations to assess, you know, what makes the most sense and where the cleanest runway is for us right now to solve the problem that we're looking to solve, which is the more efficient, the greater efficiency in the movement and management of data for nonprofit organizations is, you know, boom, we're going to choose this marketplace and this product line. And that means letting go of these couple of other things for right now. So it's a mix of both. But at the end of the day, you know, my performance is judged on how well are clients using our product and, you know, how many organizations are using our product. And so I need to be very disciplined in choosing what I do each day that leads towards that end goal. And Chris needs to be, you know, focusing his time on, you know, how much code of the code features are successfully implemented in the slickest way possible against the client commitments that we've made. And, you know, Kathy's managing its project timelines, and we keep that front and center. So really no different than in sense any other business. It's just, I think we're inventing more, or at least in our heads inventing more.
Mm-hmm. So you've been in the nonprofit space for a while, and this is a question that we like to ask our guests. you know, to kind of drill down into what motivates them to get up every morning and get to work and get through the day. Are there any nonprofits out there that you take particular inspiration from that you'd like to kind of call out to say, like, this is the kind of work that I love supporting?
Sure, yeah. So there's two that...
No, you have to pick one.
I have to pick one?
You can pick one as your favorite, and then the other one can
all right,
be
well,
second favorite.
My favorite, absolutely, hands down, is Habitat for Humanity. And there's a bit of a story behind that I'll make short. My father owned his own construction company, and I worked for him since I was maybe 8, 9 years old. You know, he'd pay us $1 an hour to go to the job site and mostly sweep and stay out of everybody's way. But, you know, it ultimately, working for my dad... both the kind of people that I worked with and the environments that I was in and just that hands-on work, I just love construction. And when I started in direct response fundraising, I was at Craver Matthew Smith & Company in the early part of my career. One of the first clients that I pitched and won was for Habitat for Humanity. And really
the
got,
DC branch?
No, this was an international organization okay. down in Americus, Georgia. So it was kind of the first account I was an account director for, and it kind of cut my teeth. And from a fundraising perspective, did a lot of great things. You know, helped them program their database to run a sustainer program. They had no technology internally to do a monthly giving program, and so really took them from $25 million. And every year got to work on the Jimmy Carter Work Project and build houses, you know, with President Carter. Got very involved in the group here locally. So, you know, for me to do the construction work I grew up with as a kid and seeing the eyes and the spirit of the family getting the keys to their house and knowing that they're going to be in a safer place and they're paying back that loan is helping somebody else get a house and just really fundamentally transforming one, you know, of the key roots of poverty is huge.
That's great. I was just on a video shoot last week with the local Habitat for Humanity here in D.C. over in Ivy City.
Yeah.
And I got to interview one of the guys who was a Habitat homeowner. Mm-hmm. And I actually started crying when I was talking to him. Yeah. It was really, really powerful because it's very tangible, too. Yeah. You know, it's like you get to see that person and the transformation that's happening in their lives.
Yeah.
I'll second that. They're cool. Brian?
What, am I going to give a nonprofit this week?
Sure, why not?
Oh, gosh.
I was just going to ask you to give a shout-out to Habitat for Humanity. But...
Yeah, I mean, they're great.
Oh, he's being very lukewarm. I can see it in his eyes. He's not truly committed to what he's
saying. Homelessness really bothers me. I think that's what it is. Homelessness actually bothers me. It's an institutional problem that the country should be ashamed of. Mm-hmm. There's no excuse for it. Nobody should ever be homeless or hungry or, out of shelter. So I'm so supportive of it, but I wish we could actually address it as a nation rather than, trying to put band-aids on it.
Isolated act of good people and organizations, yeah. But not kind of.
I mean, I actually, I think basic housing, healthcare, food, I think those are basic human rights and actually should be guaranteed. So we're getting into politics here, but I love the work they're doing, but it exposes how much that's needed and how impactful it can be. And even the economics of housing a person and even guaranteeing a basic living income in a lot of communities is actually quite comparable to what they'll end up paying just to continue to have them on the street and offer those services anyways.
Yeah. Well, I'll throw my 2 cents into the political conversation. Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, I agree with you around the shame and the opportunity in this country to address homelessness, education, and hunger. And that, you know, I believe the unfortunate reality is that the true solutions to those problems are in direct conflict with the corporate capitalist nation and politics that we have. And to really solve those community problems requires a solution that goes just loggerheads against our economic structure. And there needs to be a movement of people to solve that problem, you know, and it pours right over into global, you know, sort of the global warming issue as well. Conservation is in direct conflict with capitalism, which drives our democracy and which drives our economy. And until we change some of the metrics by which we measure success in this country at an economic level and at a political level, it's, you know, unfortunate and good. It's unfortunate that the solution to poverty and the solution to hunger are left to mainly, you know, some government funding, which is getting less and less, and to the nonprofit sector to deal with, when in fact we have the capacity, the resources, and simply lack the will in this country to deal with it in a systemic, long-term way that will end poverty and educate, you know, our kids at a much higher degree, which in the long run, you know, keeps America as a country much, you know, much more competitive.
Yeah, it's interesting. I 100% agree. And I don't think homelessness is a sloppy byproduct of capitalism. I believe it's a necessity for capitalism to actually be able to sustain itself. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that goes into it, but it is inseparable. They are hand in hand. And it is a bigger question. And surprisingly, things like this are on the table. We've had a lot. I think I just being here in D.C. Over the last week, gay marriage being legalized at the federal level. There are some opportunities on the horizon. You know, they are incremental changes, but I think there are conversations being had around these issues that, I'm surprised we're having them already. I thought I was going to be an old man before maybe we got to that point, but times are changing, and it's a good time to be here in D.C. too. Lots of energy in the city.
So, Michael, you sounded pretty passionate there for a second. What is this? Might be a thread that's motivated you through the last 25 years of your professional life.
Oh, absolutely. I am. Yeah.
Why aren't you working for the man? Why Coca-Cola? Or
well, somebody? I do work for the man. I work for Chris, and he's a hell of a man. So, I work for Amen. There you go. Here's the deal with me is I am very motivated by my progressive values, and I have been since I was very young. I was very fortunate to have, parents who instilled in us kids that, you know, your good fortune should be shared, your talent should be shared, and make the world a better place. You know,
so just he's a developer, cool but he's a lefty.
Growing
from
up
Salt Lake City.
No, this growing is, up, Michael Servino Jr., my father, was he was Republican and conservative, and over time has become educated and actually posted when the Supreme Court made their ruling. Put a great post out on Facebook that, you know, I am Catholic and my religion is against this, but I think that anybody who loves anybody should be able to get married. And even though my religion is against it, I think it should be the law of the land,
huge. My dad's the same way. My dad was like a campaign for Reagan for mm-hmm. governor of California, and now he's a communist, basically.
Maybe they get all
a Reagan communist.
A Reagan communist, that's great. No, since you know, I had a really an amazing mentor and teacher in high school by the name of Marcia Hepps. She taught drama theater when I was in high school, and she had been at Columbia doing, you know, protests with the Berrigan brothers and others. And so it really came from a Quaker background and, you know, very active on women's issues and anti-war issues and anti-hunger issues. And that rubbed off on me and took what was someone who, you know, was taught by my parents to work on behalf of making the world a better place, to have that be focused and to understand that there are tools and means of civil disobedience and a protest to actually put your life into action in pursuit of something you really believe in. And I went to Georgetown University here in D.C. from Salt Lake City, Utah.
Good where Catholic I grew up. Boy, going to Georgetown?
Ah, absolutely. Catholic high school, Catholic college.
Jesuits.
And my major was philosophy. That turned me into an atheist. But the reality is that I chose to go to Georgetown because I wanted to learn about politics, and I wanted to be in the nation's capital to understand, you know, how this works and go into politics or some kind of political activity, and graduated and went to work right away for a firm – that was raising money for progressive nonprofit organizations. And that's, you know, 23 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since. I love the fact that I go into work every day and my brain power and my energy is going, you know, directly or indirectly into making, you know, helping the progressive movement. And to me, that's really important. And the volunteer work I do outside of work, you know, does the same thing.
All right. Well, geez, we've never done that before. Every Brian Cutton. So
we're finally figuring this out.
Maybe someone will start listening now. Turn into Air America.
Oh, I doubt it. They're on the other end going, God, this guy is a blowhard.
I actually think it's important. I think especially, you know, folks.
Maybe
on
we should
the,
put the red meat at the beginning of the conversation.
There you go.
Instead of the end.
I'm just saying, you know, the folks on the left, there's a good percentage of us that do care about who we work with. You know, we're not always able to be selective about every company we do business with, but sometimes it's nice to know that, you know, folks that really get nonprofits or get what it's like to be working those late nights, you know, mm-hmm. putting the proposals together or reports for the board, like they really understand what that's all about,
yeah.
and what drives you know, you coming into work in the morning.
Yeah.
So it definitely is something I'm seeing that
yeah.
folks are starting to become more aware of.
And those values flow from the, you know, from the top down. And I, you know, the when I worked at CMS, the early part of my career, you know, we only worked for moderate and progressive organizations. And I really valued that in the company. And when, you know, I struggled at Commerce One because this was a web design and development company I went to work for. They got purchased by Avnet. They got purchased by Commerce One way back in the day. And, you know, we did corporate work and we did conservative work and we did, you know, work with the progressive side. And it just never really quite felt right to me. And, you know, I had taken 2 years between my first job and Commerce One to work for a company that did Fortune 500 CRM consulting. And it was great. It was great from the perspective of I got to learn on the job and get essentially my MBA doing corporate work on you know, strategy and work with huge amounts of money for database projects and analytic projects and all kinds of stuff. And at the end of the day, I just didn't feel good about myself.
Shareholder value wasn't enough to.
I love to tell. You know, you can edit this out if you want, but I love to tell the story. I worked on a project for Bancomer, which is the largest bank in Mexico City, and it was a CRM strategy project. And the core of it was that their data was all siloed. They had banking customers, and they had investment customers, and they had short-term loan and car loan. You know, each of these types of products were in separate databases, and they had no connection between them. And what they found, you know, through our analysis, we brought the data from all the systems together, and we did this big analysis, and we looked at the value of their customers. And you know, what it yielded was, hey, you guys are closing the credit cards of customers who are super high net worth individuals in the bank side, and you don't even know it. And and you're approving, you know, auto loans for people who on your banking side are overdrawn, and you got to fix this. So here's our strategy. You know, we'll give you this integrated view of your customers, and you're going to give extra services to your high net worth individuals, and you're going to raise the fees on your lower value customers. And a little voice in the back of my head went off and said, Servino, you are here in Mexico City. You're staying at the Four Seasons Hotel. You flew first class to tell some of the richest men in Mexico City in this presentation that they should screw the poor. What the hell are you doing? And it was about 2 weeks later I realized this is not the job for me. Turned in my resignation and moved on. And never regretted it. I mean, I missed that opportunity and some of the people I worked with, but I think, you know, we each of us make the choices about how we're going to use our energies and talents in the world, and this is how I've chosen.
Well, we'd like to have you back when you guys are hitting 20 million and you don't care about the poor people anymore.
You just want them
to get off your property and off your private
not
beach.
Not at all. Well, I mean, one of the key reasons that I did decide to work with Fracture is that commitment to only work with moderate and progressive organizations stays in place with Fracture. So I like that. It makes it easy, clean, and just rewarding for me to put myself into it 100%, knowing, you know, it aligns with what I believe.
So Donald Trump calls, not a chance you're going to return that call, huh?
Not for me, anyway.
Okay.
Well, I used to love returning those calls. When I know I get to tell somebody no, Those are the best calls. I get other people in the office around on those ones. I'm like, come listen. That's a lot of fun. It's nice to be able to say no. Yeah. Like, we don't want your business. It's not about money. Mm.
So, Michael, we need to tap into some of that creative entrepreneurial spirit of yours. We have been struggling to find a way to end the podcast. We say thank you.
This is not the time to be having this conversation.
No. Okay. Well, I thought maybe we could put him on the spot.
How to end the podcast?
Yeah.
So,
what's your favorite podcast? Is there any other that you feel like we should try to emulate?
I think that my favorite podcast is, well, I can't really say. What I listen to podcast is Wait, Don't Tell Me, because most of what I'm consuming is sort of, video online stuff.
There's not a lot of podcasts. Did they come to D.C. recently?
They did a couple months ago. So anyway, you can edit all of that out. I would suggest a couple of options for how to close. I think one is... what's your projection of how X is gonna play out? So just say a few words on that. Two, asking if you want to get the human side of it, asking the individual to bring their favorite short poem or quote of a person, to ask them, look, to close out, give us a little background on this piece that you're gonna read, why it's meaningful to you, and sort of end on that sentiment.
Well, you're setting yourself up for some embarrassing 30 seconds here when we ask you to sing a song to close us out or something.
Name that tune.
So you want to ask your question?
Give us an inspirational quote. Sure. What's in the signature line of your email address these days?
In the signature line of my email address, it's a great question. I don't have anything in the signature line, but I will give you something recently that has really been inspiring me. It's Stiff Little Fingers, which is a punk band from going way back out of Ireland. Is touring. They'll be here in D.C. July 9th. And on their new album is a number of really great tunes, and one of which, the lyrics of which echo, I won't go back to those dark places. And is really a song all about coming to peace and to terms and addressing and dealing with sort of personal demons and guilt stories and shame stories. And for me, I've been listening to that song over and over and over again, about the sentiment of I won't go back to those dark places. Because just for me right now, and personally in my life, it's a place I'm at in my, mid-40s of, really recognizing and honoring myself and a lot of the things I've accomplished and a lot of places that I am and part of the personal healing work that I'm involved in on a volunteer basis, is, helping people appreciate who they are, what they're about, and live looking forward and live in hope rather than being stuck in those dark places that disable us from being able to live our lives fully.